Welcome to a very special presentation of the novel A Really Good Day by James Hosek. On its surface, it's a story about a remarkable round of golf. But if you're not a golfer, if you quickly change the channel, if you accidentally come upon a tournament on TV, I encourage you to listen anyway. It's a story about family and friendship. It's a story about redemption and second chances. It's a story about promises made and promises kept. It's a story about once-in-a-lifetime experiences. But most of all, it is one man's love letter to his family. That man was my brother, the author, James Hosek. Aside from being an amazing veterinarian, woodworker, gardener, husband, father, brother, son, and friend, he was a writer. Writers are often told to write what they know. And in this, his first book, he did that in more ways than I can count. It will make you laugh. It will make you cry. And it will make you stand up and cheer. So sit back and enjoy as Jim takes you on a fun, entertaining journey through 18 holes of golf and one man's really good day. Chapter 18, 13th hole. Just an easy par 3, 185 yards, Ellie said into her microphone. Sand to the left and right, but the front and back of the green are unguarded. If they use the right club, they should be on the green. Unless Patterson has a great tee shot, he'll have a tough time picking up a stroke on this hole. It's actually the easiest hole on the course.
Thanks, Ellie,
Jason said. He went on to give his commentary as Andrew Patterson put his ball in the tee area and stood up, looking straight at the hole. Ellie's camera had a side shot of the tee that showed him looking to the right of the television camera. Ellie added, I think he has a 6-iron. Jason incorporated the detail into his observations, and thousands of heads across the nation nodded in agreement with the selection of the club. Andrew could par this hole with his eyes closed. If he could put his tee shot within inches of the pin, adding another birdie to the growing list was not out of question. The way Hanover had been hitting lately, he'd likely end up on the 14th tee. Maybe, Andrew considered, he might even capture an eagle for himself. Why should a nobody like Hanover be able to score a hole-in-one and not him? No, he told himself. He couldn't think that way. If he tried too hard, he'd mess it up. He banished the thoughts of a hole-in-one from his mind and pictured the ball visible on the green, inches from the pin. He looked down at the ball sitting on the tee he had sunk nearly flush with the grass. He let the weight of the club, his 6-iron, hang in his hands for a moment. With his robot-like precision, he drew the club back and swung at the ball. It rose gracefully and headed straight for the pin. The applause started before the ball even landed, and with a thunk, audible from 185 yards away, it stuck on the green, 6 inches from the hole.
Way to go, Fancy Pants,
yelled a familiar voice from behind him. He ignored the comment and basked in the moment. He imagined the television picture showing him frozen with his club hanging over his left shoulder, in a split screen with the ball sitting inches from the hole. He was ready. The pro-am was in the proverbial bag. He lowered his club, dug out his tee, and walked off the back of the tee to where Eric was standing. The boy's mouth was agape at the splendor of the shot as he absently took the club from Andrew. Karen smiled as the shot was replayed on the television screens. She finished tying her shoes. She glanced at the ones she had been wearing and tossed them into a nearby garbage can. She wouldn't be sad to see them go. Carousel seemed impressed by Andrew's tee shot on 13 and asked, "What ball is he playing?" "Why, Callaway, of course," she answered, relieved that Patterson really was using Callaway tours. "This boy may prove to be of interest after all. I'd still like to see him in the lead," he commented.
He may be, after this hole, definitely by the next one, April assured him. She leaned back and looked at Karen, raising her eyebrows, silently asking if that was possible. Karen nodded almost imperceptibly, and April smiled and looked back at the screen. Two more holes, she said.
Excellent, said Carousel.
Where is that tea?
Jake stood with other onlookers in the clearing behind the 13th green. From his vantage point, it looked like Patterson's ball was going to hit near where he stood, but it seemed to lose speed rapidly and acted as though a magnet in the hole was pulling it down. The shot was sure to put a little pressure on Scott. Pressure Scott didn't need, now that his lead was only one stroke. Even though Jake didn't have a golf club in his hand, he was feeling the pressure, too. He really had thought that if Scott could win this, he could convince him and his wife to parlay the experience into a decent payday.
Hang in there, he thought.
He tried to push the assurance across the neatly mowed grass to where Scott now stood on the tee.
You can do it.
Scott let out a breath that was almost a growl. Patterson wasn't making this easy. He looked around until he spotted Sarah and the other women. He waved and she waved back. She looked a little uncomfortable, but so would he if he was walking around over 8 months pregnant. But he was so glad she was there. He shook out his left hand a few more times. The sides of his palm still ached from Lane's gorilla grip. He hadn't thought the old man had it in him. What a goofy thing to do to a guy who was having a little trouble with his swing. He set up his ball and laid his 6-iron on the grass slightly behind it. He grasped the grip with his left hand, then his right, laying his right pinky over the left forefinger, a little lower on the shaft.
God, my left hand hurts, was all he could think.
He gripped a little tighter with his right hand, then took a practice swing. He surprised even himself with the swing. It felt perfect. He had been doing something wrong the last couple of holes, but now he was back to the swing he had on the driving range. He felt his brain settling into the balanced state he had imagined earlier, like two pools of liquid equally balanced in the two halves of his skull. He took a second practice swing, not letting himself think about things, but letting his body settle into the feel of the swing, the weight of the club, the rustle of his pants legs, the speed of his body. The club whooshed over the grass in a path that would take the ball straight to the pin. He sighed and chuckled to himself. Lang had done the hand squeeze on purpose. Scott had not been playing golf. He had been swinging a club, and swinging it poorly. He had been feeling the pressure and started over-analyzing things, slipping into old bad habits. Patterson was getting to him. He'd been playing against the man, even though Patterson didn't matter. It was what Scott did that mattered. He knew he had great shots in him. He'd seen a few every time he went out. Most of the time they came when he least expected it. Today, he was starting to expect it all the time, and was actually beginning to believe he was a better golfer than he thought he was. Sure, he had the best score of his life, but next week or next year or 5 years from now, when he picked up his clubs again, he would quite likely have the worst game of his life. The pain in his hand was almost gone, but the lesson wasn't. Technically, this was an easy shot. It was an easy hole. Even on a bad day, he should do well. He stepped up to the ball. Almost with surprise, his body started the backswing. He let it take over, and for the split second the club hovered above his head, everything was perfect. The club arced down, and the ball sailed out over the grass. It headed straight for the pin.
"It's in the hole," shouted someone in the crowd.
Scott knew it would be short, but not by much. The ball didn't stick like Patterson's, but bounced forward and landed a yard shy of the hole.
"Way to go, Hanover," Paul said. His hand was on Scott's right shoulder, and Scott realized he was still standing in his after-swing pose, his club hanging over his left shoulder. "I bet Patterson thought he was getting another stroke on you this hole." "He still may. That's no gimme." "It's a piece of cake. Piece of pie. Lemon meringue with whipped cream." "Make a cheesecake. Strawberries on top." Scott laughed. "Definitely doable," said Paul.
"Definitely not a gimme," countered Scott.
"Ah, come on, it's done. It's in the hole. The fact that you can still see it is just a technicality."
"With your optimism, I'm surprised it doesn't just roll in right now."
"Give it a minute," Paul said.
They laughed, and Paul took the club, sliding it into the bag over his shoulder, and the two walked down the slight hill towards the green. Scott found Sarah and waved. She waved back, then held her hands a yard apart. She was really getting into this.
Cool, thought Scott.
Andrew and Eric followed. Andrew was shaking his head almost imperceptibly with disbelief.
Where did that come from?
Hanover almost looked like he knew what he was doing.
Kenny Chase had been on the street nearly half an hour and had traveled about a mile before he saw what he was looking for. The blue signs with the white outlines of a cat and dog sitting side by side sat next to the large white letters proclaiming Oak Forest Animal Clinic.
"They'll have one," he thought to himself.
He parked the red Blazer with the Northern Illinois Amateur Golf Association logo decal on the side of the door in front of the clinic. The little sign in the window indicated they were open, and through the large plate glass windows that looked into the waiting room, he noted two dogs on leashes and one woman trying to calm what he presumed was a cat in a pet carrier. He bustled through the door and walked up to the woman sitting behind the desk.
"Do you have an X-ray machine?" he asked.
She stared past him, confused at his lack of a pet.
"Is the animal in the car?" she asked with concern.
Perhaps the pet was too injured to come in on its own power.
"Oh, no, miss. I don't have a pet."
He thought a moment, then added,
"It is sort of animal-related, in a way."
She looked confused.
"We have an X-ray machine. What do you need?"
"A favor," he said, and pulled a white ball out of his pocket and placed it on the counter, with the yellow duck logo facing up.
"I need an X-ray of this ball."
The woman looked even more confused and squinted at Kenny, concerned about his sanity.
"We don't do that."
Her answer was slow, with some hesitation between the words. She had heard a lot of strange requests over the years, but this was the first golf ball X-ray she had been asked to perform.
"It's very important. I'll pay whatever the normal charge is," he added. "Connie, what's going on?" asked a woman in a white lab coat.
She had walked up to the counter and laid a manila folder with colored tabs along the edge in front of the receptionist.
"This man wants his pet golf ball X-rayed."
"Did it swallow a tea?" asked the doctor.
She laughed at her joke, and Connie laughed, too.
"It's not my pet. I need an X-ray of this ball. I'll pay double your normal fee," Kenny said,
hoping that Bateman would reimburse him the expense.
"What's this for?"
Her name tag identified her as Dr. Susan Galway.
"We need to make sure the ball is legal. It's for a tournament. It's on TV," he added.
"He's right," drawled one of the men, waiting with his dog in the plastic chairs along the window. "Saw a bit of it before I had to bring Kaiser in for his blood test. Guy hit a hole one, he did."
"That's right," Kenny said.
"Please, it'll take a few minutes and I'll be out of here."
"I don't mind waiting," replied Kaiser's owner. "Never seen an X-ray of a golf ball before."
"Teddy," yelled Dr. Galway to the back. "Do you have time for an X-ray?"
A short, bespectacled man with a crew cut and animal print scrubs appeared.
"Of what?"
Susan Galway picked up the ball, noticing the yellow duck printed on the side for the first time.
"A duck," she answered.
Teddy's forehead wrinkled in confusion as she placed the ball in his palm. His eyes widened, and the look on Dr. Galway's face told him she was serious.
I'll see what I can do, he answered.
How's it going? Sally asked.
How's what going? Sarah asked in return.
The contractions.
Oh, that. Nothing yet. I think it was just a one-time thing with that last one. Probably exerting myself a little too much.
It has been over 10 minutes, Gina pointed out.
Let's go sit on that bench, Sally said. To the right of the green and near the sign labeling the next hole as the 14th was a wooden bench. A few people stood on it now trying to get a look at the 13th green, but not wanting to give up their prime viewing spot for the tee shots on 14.
After Scott putts, promised Sarah.
Okay, agreed Sally. But if another one comes, we head right there.
I'll be right behind you, Sarah said.
Andrew marked his ball with the golden dollar and picked it up. He walked to the back of the green, paying no attention to Scott. Scott and Paul examined the green and both decided it was a straight shot.
Good luck, buddy, Paul said.
Thanks.
Scott lined up his feet and set the speed of his putt with 3 practice swings. He stepped up and pulled back the club when a bee landed on the ball. He stopped, stood up, and waited a minute, but the bee remained stubbornly on the ball.
Is there a problem? Asked the red-jacketed official who had given Scott a hard time on the front nine.
There's a bee on my ball, Scott said,
loud enough for the crowd to hear. A chuckle spread through the onlookers.
Well, shoot off and play.
I don't want to get stung.
Scott looked back at the ball and watched. The bee seemed to be extremely interested in the yellow duck.
I think he thinks it's a flower.
Another chuckle. Then Henderson rolled his eyes back, stomped to where Scott's ball sat, bent over, and waved his hand over it. This, apparently, was the wrong thing to do. The bee took off. It started to buzz at the logo on the man's jacket. He stumbled backwards, brushing at the insect, but it persisted in hovering by his chest. He almost fell as he continued to walk backwards. He turned and ran into the crowd. Scott couldn't see if the bee was still following him, but the crowd gathered around the hole was now in stitches, Scott along with them. He was almost crying at the sight of the large, sweaty man battling the tiny bee, when suddenly there was a yelp from deep inside the crowd.
I guess he found a better flower, Scott said, to the delight of the crowd.
With a big grin on his face, he set up his shot again. Not trusting his memory, he set his putting speed with a few practice swings and then stepped up to the ball. The crowd noise died off quickly as they sensed his need for concentration. He eyed the path he wanted the ball to take.
Straight in, he told himself.
He drew the club back and tapped the ball forward. It rolled toward the hole, inching to the right side, caught the rim, rolled nearly 360 degrees around the opening, hesitated, and dropped in. The onlookers exploded into appreciative applause.
Show off, shouted one man.
Cheesecake, Paul said from behind him. Knew it the whole time.
At least one of us did, Scott said.
Hey, buddy, that's what you hired me for.
I'll never doubt you again, Scott promised.
Ah, wait until next hole, answered Paul.
This is ridiculous, thought Andrew as he walked up to the hole. He placed his ball in front of the coin, then picked up the golden dollar by its edges. As he stood up, the coin twisted in his fingers and fell on the ball, causing it to roll an inch to the left. Andrew froze in horror. What had he done? The ball had moved. Was that a penalty? He couldn't remember the rule. Why did he have to use such a huge, heavy coin? A little dime would have just bounced off. He stood up, panicked. The eyes of the onlookers indicated he was not the only one who had seen the unintended motion of the ball. A red-jacketed official approached him. It was a different one than had shooed the bee away. If only it had been as simple as a bug on his ball. What had he done?
The official had a tiny book in his hands, and he was flipping through the pages one by one as he came to Andrew.
"Just need to be sure," he said,
as he stopped a foot away from the ball and the incriminating coin lying on the green. He continued flipping pages. Alf Redding had zoomed in on Patterson's face. Jason pushed the button to talk to Freddy.
"What's the rule, Freddy?"
"I'm checking."
"Well, let me know before the official announces it."
"I think it's no penalty,"
said Freddy.
"You think?"
"I'm pretty sure."
"I know I don't know this stuff, Freddy, but I don't want to sound like I don't know it."
"It could go either way,"
answered Freddy.
"What do you mean?"
"Here's the rule. See what you make of it."
Jason sighed and turned his mic live again as he listened to Freddy relay the details to him.
He, in turn, explained them to the audience. "It's basically the official on the scene's call," he concluded.
The red-jacketed man stopped his page flipping and his face lit up.
"Here it is," he announced.
He read from the book loud enough for the closest people to hear. "If a ball or ball marker is accidentally moved in the process of lifting the ball or marking its position, the ball or ball marker shall be replaced. There is no penalty provided the movement of the ball or the ball marker is directly attributable to the specific act of marking the position of or lifting the ball. I consider removing the ball marker as part of the act of marking the ball. There will be no penalty," he announced.
A few boos issued from the crowd,
but Andrew closed his eyes in relief and let out the breath he found himself holding. He moved the ball to its original position, picked up the coin, palming it in his fist, and then pocketing it. He stepped into position. The official slipped his rule book into his jacket pocket and stepped back. Andrew tapped in the putt. The crowd applauded, but not with great enthusiasm. The call, Andrew realized, was slightly controversial. If he had dropped the coin while starting to mark the ball, there would be no question. But the call was made, and he wasn't going to argue it. He pulled his ball out of the hole. Eric replaced the flag and took the gold-handled putter, wiping the head before replacing it in its sleeve.
"Should have been a penalty stroke," Paul whispered.
"It could go either way," Scott said, disagreeing.
"You were robbed."
"I can afford it," he answered.
"That bee was hilarious," Paul added, changing the subject.
"I thought that guy was going to land on his butt," Scott said.
"Where do you think it stung him?"
"One can only hope."
Several red-jacketed men and women opened a corridor through the crowd. Bateman and Frisk led the party using their golf cart, and the golfers followed. There was no sign of the bee attack victim as Scott scanned the faces. There was no sign of Sarah, either. She must have moved to the next fairway, he concluded.
"Oh, boy," gasped Sarah.
Sally and Gina took their positions and helped Sarah walk toward the bench. She tapped the leg of one of the men standing on it.
"Hey," he said, "I was here first. Go find some—"
He looked down at Sally, and his eyes caught the grimace on Sarah's face and the bulge in her stomach. He elbowed the guy next to him.
"Get off the bench, Eddie."
"What?"
asked Eddie, trying to get a view of the golfers.
"Lady needs to sit down."
He hopped off and dragged Eddie with him.
"Oh, yeah, be our guest,"
Eddie insisted, once he had taken in the situation.
"Thank you," Gina said.
She and Sally lowered Sarah to the seat and sat next to her. 16 minutes, Gina said, as Sarah puffed through the contraction.
"We're getting you out of here," Sally said, insistent.
Sarah's breathing began to return to normal.
"Not as bad as the last time," she gasped.
"You're sweating like a pig," observed Sally.
"Even if this is real labor, not a false labor like my sister thought, it could be hours before anything significant starts to happen. My water hasn't even broken yet."
"I'm with Sally," Gina said.
"Well, I say I can make it," Sarah insisted.
"I just need a little rest. Sit down and take some pressure off everything, and I'll be okay." Sally gave her a questioning stare.
"I'm still timing them," Gina said.
Sarah nodded and took a few deep, cleansing breaths.
"It'll be fine," she insisted again. "My sister was in labor 22 hours with her first kid. My mom was 28. I have a long labor genetically programmed into me. I'm not going to drop a kid on the 18th tee," she joked. "I'll wait until Scott gets on the green."
The others laughed with her. "Looks like he found his game again," commented Joe Calkin.
"He still has 5 holes to play," Ted reminded him.
"Isn't it just as likely Patterson will mess up?"
Ted thought for a moment. "Yeah, I suppose that could happen. But something doesn't feel right."
"What do you mean?"
"Something has to happen to stop Patterson."
"Something like what?"
"You tell me. You know more about the man than I do," said Ted.
"He never makes a mistake," said Joe.
"He did just now," Ted reminded him.
"What, the coin? That was an accident."
"Fortunately, it was one that didn't cost him anything. But if things go just right, something may happen that he has no direct control over. His caution will end up doing him in," Ted explained.
"That would be nice."
A new red-jacketed official had taken over the officiating on the tee.
"Mr. Patterson is up," he announced. "Quiet on the tee."
"Here we go," Ted said.
Thank you for listening to A Really Good Day, a novel by James Hosek, narrated by Rich Hosek. If you are interested in purchasing a hardcover edition of this story for yourself or a golfer in your life, visit jimbooks.myshopify.com. You'll get free shipping in the United States. You'll also get the complete audiobook and ebook editions with your purchase. And make sure to subscribe to the mailing list for updates about the upcoming release of his Doctor at Mystery series, cozy mysteries about a crime-solving veterinarian. Thanks again, and all the very best.